Welcome to Season 7 of the HPS Cast. I'm your host, Colbert Cannon. If you're new to the pod, HPS is a global investment firm. We manage approximately $95 billion in assets for a broad range of institutional and retail investors. That capital is invested across private credit and public credit strategies. Each week, I sit down with key relationships to, partners of, and friends of the firm to learn from their experience, ask how that experience shapes their current roles, and give insights into HPS and how we operate. So with that, let's bring in our guest. Our guest this week runs loan trading for Europe, the Middle East, and Africa for a leading global investment bank in London. He's a very talented athlete, having played semi-professional soccer or football for our international audience at clubs like Slough Town and Boreham Wood. But he decided his talents were better directed towards the business world. And after graduating from Oxford, he worked first at Rothschild and then on to JP Morgan, where he has made his career since. In addition to his work in the debt trading world, he has kept close to his sporting interests as the director of recently promoted Premier League side Brentford FC. And he's also committed to making the world a better place, notably both through his involvement with the educational charity Future First. And last year, he also was appointed by the FA to chair its Inclusion Advisory Board, all of which should tell you that this is a man committed to driving success and social change across quite a broad range of arenas. He's a good friend of the firm and close with my colleagues in London, so I'm thrilled to welcome in this week's HPS Cast guest, Deji Davies, JP Morgan, head of European loan trading. Deji, welcome to the pod.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Well, Deji, I like to go all the way back to start. Where are you from originally? Where'd you grow up?
So I grew up in Camden, which I guess you've got an international listenership. So that's in North London, kind of inner city London. A Nigerian father, Canadian mother, who both moved to London years ago. My upbringing really did influence the work I've done in terms of the inclusion and community side because of what I experienced around me and the people that I saw and the outcomes they had. So, you know, quite early on, I became quite passionate about trying to have an impact and help those people through the experience that I had.
That's fantastic. Well, let's talk about that career path because it wasn't as linear as some in your kind of job. So let's start with football. How did you start playing as a youngster?
I mean, from really early on in my estate, we'd play every weekend just outside and at school, every break time, every lunchtime. But yeah, I played at school mainly, then did a number of soccer schools outside of school with Arsenal, with actually Tottenham, and also just in my local council. I then, at Oxford, got into the Blues team. That was a wonderful 3 years. Then after that, I went on to play semi-professional football. Whilst at that time, I was already thinking about my later career, I'd already accepted to be a professional footballer at the top level. I probably wasn't quite good enough, so I was already thinking about business, but carried on playing semi-professionally for a while whilst I started my career in finance and the amateur level.
Let's start on your semi-professional career. So our audience will know professional, you know, perennial Premier League sides. You mentioned Arsenal, Tottenham, Man U, et cetera. But names like Boreham Wood or Slough Town are going to be less familiar. Can you give, in particular for an American audience, sort of the basics of the various leagues of football in the UK?
Absolutely. Yeah. So everyone will hear of and know the Premier League, which is the top 20 teams in the UK division. I played in what's called the fifth or sixth division, as it were. So a pretty serious level of football. And actually the commitment required is high. Part of the magic of playing for a semi-pro club is that in theory could get drawn against the top biggest clubs out there. I didn't actually play against anyone as big as a Premier League club, but it's possible.
So Deji, you mentioned you already had in the back of your mind, you weren't sure it was going to be the full-time career for you. Was there a moment when you thought, you know, this is it? Like, I really need to get on with the rest of my life. How did that realization come to you?
Yeah, do you know, there was one season, which I kind of think of as my sliding doors moment. So I was playing for Wembley at the time. It was my first semi-pro club. I was top scorer at Christmas. And I had a number of scouts come down and you know, give me their card before the game and say, I'm here to look at you, which was a surprise to me because I'd never thought about it as a career or thought this is possible. And then I started to think, okay, maybe football is possible. I then moved to Slough, which was a disaster move. The whole culture of the club, I didn't score one goal there. The team wasn't doing well. A lot of us got let go. I then went back to Wembley, carried on scoring straight away. But then that season, because I had that period of being at Slough not scoring, I ended up second top scorer in the whole division. The guy that finished top scorer, he had a trial at Chelsea, then a trial at Watford, was signed by Watford. And I saw that and thought, that was kind of my chance. And the fact that I left, and look, don't regret it. I learned a lot from that move. It reminded me why I actually play football, which is the joy of it. Whereas I was probably back then seduced by a bigger club offering more to me and really learned a lot from that. So I kind of took that as a message that this is not meant to be. So I was kind of starting to really just focus more on my financial career, which I really enjoy as well.
Yeah. So let's start there then. So it's time to get onto the business world. You're an Oxford graduate. How did that first job come about? Like, how did you get that first opportunity at Rothschild?
after Oxford, I went traveling initially. I went around the world and spent most of my time in South America. And I did a lot of time there whilst I was living with a family in Bolivia, learning Spanish, thinking about next steps. And I kept coming back to finance. I studied economics and management at Oxford. And it was just always something I was curious about and reading up about and interested in understanding what made certain companies more successful than others. How did economic markets really work? How did ecosystems work together? So it just became clear to me it was a natural interest for me. And I'd always been quite good at maths and science, and it lent itself to being, you know, successful in finance. So I came back from travels and I just started to apply to a number of different graduate programs, highly competitive, highly difficult. And then at Rothschild, probably the hardest one to get given the numbers. So I was very privileged to get placed on that. And I started on the graduate program there, rotated through all the advisory businesses and M&A, DCM, ECM, and ended up on the investing side, which is really, you know, aligned to what I really am interested in. And then putting your money to work and actually investing in companies.
I'm always interested. You'd had a semi-professional background. You had this academic background, but it's academic, right? It's not, you know, you're not a business major undergrad at Oxford. I'm always interested as people learn on the job. Like, how did you get up the curve on things that you didn't know when you're getting thrown into the wolves, you know, at Rothschild in the graduate program?
Well, that's a really great question. And the brilliant thing about Rothschild, and this is why I think of it so fondly, my time there, is it's a very small organization with a very flat structure. So to give you an example, 10 of us on the grad program, you know, and day one in leveraged finance, where I spent most of my time there, I was given credit, so sent to bank meetings, quite a junior banker at this point, thrust into credit committee to present the paper, answer questions, then monitor the asset. And that was just me. You were just thrown in. It was kind of sink or swim, but incredibly motivating as a young banker to just be forced to take ownership of everything. It kind of aligns to football, right? Every turn, every move you make is being assessed and can result in some great things or the opposite. So I'm quite used to this pressurized environment. I think I thrive on that, and you either enjoy that or don't. You know, thankfully I do.
Okay, so 2007, you make the move over to JP Morgan. Tell me about how that opportunity came about.
So at the time, this might sound strange now, given I think a lot of people look at that as an easy move to make. It was a really difficult decision. I loved Rothschild. You know, it was my first full job. They were really supporting me to thrive at the firm and putting a lot in place for me to be a senior leader there. And JP Morgan, you know, we were effectively like a buy-side shop. We were an investor, even though it was in a bank. And we were out for dinner. And after the dinner, one of my now colleagues at JP Morgan pulled me aside and commenced what was a 9-month courtship program. And it took that long only because I was so happy at Rothschild. But the more and more I thought about the opportunity, the scale, you know, the reality of what JP Morgan was as a leader in the field, it was something I couldn't say no to.
So you're sitting on a London trading desk just in time for the world to fall apart in the global financial crisis. Tell me what you remember and how you managed through that crazy time.
Yeah, I mean, so I spent the first 6 months of my time at JP Morgan just convinced I'm going to be fired here, right? I mean, it's a financial crisis, but actually it was an incredible time to join. I learned that JP Morgan, thankfully, you know, through, you know, the right decision-making, came into that and out of that in a better place than many of our peers. And what's clear, it was an incredible learning opportunity and investing opportunity. And when I came in, I was relatively junior, but was able to take ownership of some of the risk and learn on the job as to how to really navigate markets like that, which, you know, some people wait 10, 20 years for opportunities like that. So I really look back at that time as, yes, initially quite unnerving because I didn't know how JP Morgan would respond, but actually an essential component to my future development.
Well, and you learn so much more when things are going wrong, right? When everything's sort of benign and up to the right, that's never like the most educational part of our job. So today you run European loan trading for JP Morgan. For those less familiar, what does that job actually entail? What do you actually do?
It's twofold, really. So we're a market maker. We provide liquidity to the street across various clients, and that's banks, CLOs, credit funds, hedge funds, insurance companies, pension companies. So it's a broad set of clients that we interact with, and we make two-way markets and trade loans. Also, we invest in loans ourselves as well and take positions and take risks. So my job and the way that we make money is effectively making markets and making bid offer there, but also and often the kind of more meaningful P&L is driven by making right investment calls. And that's part of the job I'm really interested in, where you're analyzing a company, sitting down with your analyst and deciding, does this make sense to buy here? And then folding that in with what the market is doing. Because one of the biggest lessons I learned is your fundamental analysis can be on point, and you've diligently, you know, spent hours understanding the business bottom up, inside out. You feel you're an expert in the company, but the market will dictate, you know, whether you're right or wrong on that. And you might be right in 2 years, but if you're wrong now, you know, we mark to market, it hurts. Right? Yeah. And you need to respect the market, as it were.
Yeah, and early can still be wrong. You're exactly right.
Exactly.
Well, so you mentioned, you know, you've been sitting in that desk and managing through, you know, first COVID, and now we're recording this in the first quarter of 23. Markets are still unsettled. Inflation and rates are up for the first time in over a decade. Talk to me about managing your operation with that amount of volatility. Like, what do you have to do differently in a market like this versus the more benign credit environments?
Really difficult. So I think the first thing you need to do is suspend your conviction around the long term. Looking further than, you know, 1 or 2 months ahead even is pretty difficult. I mean, all of last year, the amount of times we collectively as a team sat down and said, well, we were completely wrong about that. Clearly, this is true, was countless, right? You need to just adjust what you're used to in terms of your time horizon, firstly. And secondly, just your comfort level around risk and risk positioning needs to evolve and adjust clearly, right? Because the amount of unknowns, I mean, you look at this week, right? Just having just left the desk now, the market is super bid. You know, it's been a very strong start to the year. You know, if we were talking even 3 weeks ago, we'd probably have a different tone to the discussion we're having now. But it looks like, you know, there's a narrative around, has inflation peaked? You know, energy prices are coming down. You know, is the guaranteed recession actually going to be quite mild and maybe shorter lived than was expected? So, I have a view today as to where I think markets are going, but I'm well aware that that could be a very different picture in 2 weeks. And staying nimble and able to respond as markets evolve is, I think, one of the most key skill sets to have in markets like this.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. The best investors in markets like this, you just have to be dynamic in your thinking. And you're exactly right. Feels great right now. And who knows where we're going to be, as you say, let alone in a couple months, in a couple days, right? It's that kind of environment. Okay, well, Deji, let's talk outside of work for a bit. As we said, you've kept some part of you in the football world. You know, first, you had your appointment in 2021 as a director of Brentford. Tell me how that opportunity came about.
Football was one of my great passions. I always, you know, having played, at one point I thought, I'll probably get back into football at some stage, or at least I'd like to. How you do that is the question. And the amount of people that have come into me is, how did you manage to get a job at Brentford? How did you do? And the reason I was able to, I'm very fortunate in that Brentford is a forward-thinking club who likes to do things differently. And Brentford, they ran an audit of their own board and said, right, what are the missing skills that we do not have on our board? And rather than do what a lot of the time happens in the football industry is, okay, we need these skills. Does anyone know anyone that fits these bills? They say, well, no, let's run an open process. Let's really reach, be intentional about reaching as many people as we can. So what Brentford did is partnered with Sky Sports, which is the biggest sports channel in the UK, and ran a campaign and said, look, we are looking for a new non-executive director. These are the skill set. This is what you need to apply. Invite applications. And I looked at that and thought, well, that's pretty close to me. It was, you know, board experience, professional experience, stakeholder engagement, checking down the list. And it was kind of 90% me. And I thought, I have to apply for this. I'm not going to get it because it's a Premier. Yeah, they weren't a Premier League club at the time. Actually, they were a Championship club. They're in the second division, but still, opportunities like that just don't come about. So I applied thinking unlikely to get it, although I felt I'd be quite good at this job. And it was a very long process. With I think I met in total 16 people.
Wow,
very thorough process. And then between the last interview, which was in person at the stadium. Brentford were in the playoff final, which was a huge, huge game. I was there watching this game, at this point fully invested in Brentford, not just because I'd learned so much about the club and actually genuinely had begun to support them, because their story is just so incredible and you can't help but just be engaged by them. I then went into my interview, and at this point I'm still thinking, okay, this is quite real now. I'm in the final round, could possibly get this. And I sat down, and as I spoke to the directors there, I, throughout the process, realized I really did want it. I went from, I'll apply, I probably won't get it, to, actually, I'm really right for this. I can do a fantastic job for this. And I really want to work with these people and with this organization. And that was apparent in the conversation. It went really well. And we saw eye to eye in the way that we thought about football, about the industry, about inclusion, around community work, that it was just a natural fit. And happy to say I was offered the job.
Now, what does it mean to be the director of the club? Like, what specifically is that job for you, Deji?
So essentially, as a director, so legally, there's eight of us, we are responsible for every decision that takes place in the club, right? So we own it. We're legally responsible. Now, clearly, we're not taking those decisions, all of them. You know, a lot of them are taken by the executives. So we are there to advise and to direct and to really have a strategic vision and set the strategic vision of how the club should perform. And that is across everything. I chair the risk committee. I chair the audit committee. I also sit on the equity, diversity, and inclusion subcommittee. So each director will have skill sets aligned to their professional competence. But in boardrooms and in discussions, everyone's in the room because of the experience they have. And I've got to say that the caliber of people, as I went through the process and having worked with the team for over a year now, is really high, really impressive.
We're recording this in early 2023. Brentford is solidly mid-table and in great form, like you've won three of your last five without a loss. Having said that, how stressful is it for a recently promoted club fighting to stay up, Deji?
I've got to say, you know, it was incredibly stressful for everyone and exciting at the same time, right? So when I walked into the club, just been promoted, which, you know, it's the dream of every Brentford fan, but the level of operational requirements, you know, public requirements, media engagement, everything just explodes. So a lot to be done. The club was running, you know, 100 miles an hour for those initial months. You know, the recent World Cup break was really welcome to give people a break because, look, it's incessant. Football never stops. And, yeah, you know, the team at Brentford, everyone, I mean, really, really impressive team and diverse team. That's another very intentional outcome in terms of the composition of who we have, yeah, at board level and throughout the club.
Well, so speaking of that inclusion, you were recently appointed as the chair of the Inclusion and Advisory Board by the FA. Now, what does that mean? Like, what is that role? And what do you intend to do from that seat, Deji?
Sure. So the FA, for people that might not realize, it's the governing body of football in the UK. So the FA administer over the 23 England teams, and people may know just the men's and the women's teams, both of which have been very successful of late.
Your Lionesses have been incredibly successful. It's very exciting.
Amazing, right? So, but there's actually 23 teams below the FA look after. They own Wembley Stadium, which is obviously a huge asset nationally, and take real responsibility for governing football across the country from a grassroots level all the way up. So my role and the IAB, the Inclusion Advisory Board that I'm now chairing, the responsibility there is to try and drive more inclusion across the game. And that's from a participation level at grassroots to playing level professionally, to off pitch as well, to coaching and to, you know, even to ownership. So to really drive a more inclusive environment is the objective. And now we really want to push the dial and actually achieve some real success and outcomes, which is not an easy task. It's a three-year post that may roll over, but I look at it as a kind of a long-term project to really look back and hopefully feel like we've really improved inclusion for members of the UK that otherwise wouldn't have necessarily felt football was for them or didn't feel invited to it. You know, and that's one of the other successes of Brentford, right? Everyone I bring along to the club always says, I felt so welcome, it's incredible, your boardroom is so diverse. And, you know, the way that we think strategically around engaging with the community, making sure that the experience is one that everyone would want to come to.
Couldn't agree more. And we are huge believers in the wisdom of crowds. And that wisdom of crowds works when it's a really diverse crowd. That's the way that process is supposed to work. And it's great to see at Brentford, you've been very active at JP Morgan, I know, in the same vein. So we love seeing somebody successful in professional life doing so much to give back broadly. It's incredibly inspiring, Deji. Okay, with that, Deji, I want to move to the last segment of the pod, which is something we like to call Best Ideas. It's where we offer up something that's added value in our lives. Recently, we call it Best Ideas because it's our goal. Like a trader like yourself, as investors, we always like to maximize exposure to those. Deji, you're our guest. I'm going to ask you to go first. What's your best idea this week?
So I don't know if you've ever suffered with back pain in your life. Have you, Colbert?
Yep, I have, yep.
Right. And what I've found is most people I talk to about this, one in three people as a rough estimate as to how many people I think suffer from it. I suffered from it my whole life. And I always just thought, well, I'm quite active. I'm a sportsman. I'm tall. I just deal with it.
Is what it is, yeah.
Yeah. And it got to such a bad place that I had to stop playing football. I saw everyone, chiropractor, osteopath, reflexologist, spinal surgeon, physio, everyone. And I was about to have surgery. And before I had surgery, Nick Strong said to me, who was going through a similar pain, read this book. It's called Healing Back Pain by Dr. John Sarno. Dr. John Sarno is a reputable medical doctor of 30 years. He actually died recently, but he's celebrated in the field and he unpicks exactly why you're having back pain. And it is real pain, but there's a slight clue in the second part of the book, which is, you know, it's the mind-body connection. And during the reading of the book, I started to feel my back pain slowly dissipate. And I know that sounds incredible and odd, but it's true and it worked. And if you've suffered from chronic back pain, the possibility of a key like this that can take you from a constant pain state to a, I'm not completely pain-free, but I'm down to maybe 20% of what I was, which is far more manageable.
Amazing.
That's an incredible gift. So one I want to share with your listeners.
That's a great idea as well as the best idea. And I love that Nick Strong was part of it. So thank you for that, Deji. Fantastic stuff. Well, for me then, as listeners know, I like to be inspired by the guest of the week. And Deji obviously has made football a huge part of his life and career. And so I want to recommend one of my favorite books about sports, period, but certainly one of the great reads about soccer out there. And I have to say, until this recording, I didn't know who Deji supported, and so this couldn't have worked out better. I'm going back a bit. This book amazingly celebrated its 30th anniversary last year. My best idea this week is the incomparable book Fever Pitch by Nick Hornby. Hornby is a fantastic writer. His books High Fidelity and About a Boy are both great. They were both made into award-winning movies. You may be misled, American audiences, because you're going to think Fever Pitch as the Jimmy Fallon, Drew Barrymore Red Sox movie, which, to be clear, is not a best idea recommendation. But the original book that the movie was based on is about Hornby growing up an Arsenal fan and the importance that soccer played in his life. It is funny, it's warm, it's moving, all at once. And for my listeners, it provides a lovely insight into the unique importance of football to British culture broadly. So, in honor of my guest, a great sportsman himself, and one who has shared thoughts of the importance of football to his home country, let me recommend the book Fever Pitch by Nick Hornby. Deji, thoughts on Nick Hornby?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Must read. High Fidelity is a rite of passage. I'd highly recommend that book. It must be, but Fever Pitch, clearly. I mean, every Arsenal fan, it's actually a test of how much of an Arsenal fan someone is, whether they read that book.
Well, Deji, with that, thank you. We sincerely appreciate you taking the time to come on the show. We will all be cheering for Brentford through the rest of the season, but appreciate you taking the time.
Real pleasure. Thanks so much, Colbert.
Thanks again to our guest, Deji Davies. Check out our show notes to learn more about Deji and his role at JP Morgan and Brentford Football Club. You'll also find a link to his best idea, the book Healing Back Pain by Dr. John Sarno, and to my best idea, the book Fever Pitch by Nick Hornby. This podcast was brought to you by Atwill Media with HPS Investment Partners. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. The opinions expressed on this podcast are that of the host, Colbert Cannon, and the guest of each episode, and do not necessarily reflect the views of HPS Investment Partners.